The following episode of Faux Hop is rated MA. It contains alternating hosts, a rotating roster of guests, and mild coarse language. Faux Hop advises that it is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15, or anyone who came here looking for one of those highbrow NPR-type podcasts. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
Hello and welcome to Faux Hop. I'm Charlie Clausen, and my guest this week, she is an actor who has been in everything. If you've watched TV, you might have seen her in Wakefield, The Other Guy, No Activity, American Auto. If you've seen a film in the last 10 years, you would have seen her in Down Under, The Killing Ground, or Invisible Man. She's also the creator of the upcoming column from Accounts, Harriet Dyer. Welcome to Faux Hop.
Thanks, Charlie. It's good to be here.
I'm so glad we actually made this happen. I think I reached out to you months ago, and you were just landed in Australia when you were just about to start Colin from Accounts. How was it pulling triple, quadruple duty?
It was wild. Like, I remember when you reached out, we were in pre-production, I think, and it was just like our baby was, I don't know, 4 months old, four and a half months old, and we were, you know, going to recce's every day and checking, and script work and casting and just all this stuff. Like, you kind of can't choose when the world or, you know, the people, the powers that be, kind of green light your show. And equally, you can't really choose when adoption's going to happen.
Yeah, right.
Because you can kind of plan a natural pregnancy, you know, it's like, well, roughly 38 weeks later we'll have a baby. But adoption is one of those things where it's like, oh my God, well, if the phone rings, or if you want to match with this birth mother, then you've got to put all your hopes on her, and then she could disappear on you, and then you have to start all over again. And so all that is to say that both things kind of happened at once.
So,
but yeah, we're in pre-production now of the show, a post-production now.
Right.
So we're I'm just constantly watching my fucking face.
And like, prior to being a creator, like a writer and a producer of a show, when you were just an actor, are you an actor that can watch yourself in things or not?
Yeah. I can be a little bit mean to myself, and I understand why some people just kind of can't do it. But I think I've always had maybe a desire to do more things on a set, so maybe direct or write or produce or whatever. So I think I knew I'd have to very quickly get over myself.
Yeah. I mean,
but it's, you know, it's month whatever it is now, and honestly, I'm just like, oh, yes, that cue's fine, that piano sounds fine under my fucking face. Get my face out of my face.
I remember seeing an interview with Jim Carrey once where he was asked the same question, like, you know, do you find it difficult? And the standard answer from a Hollywood star is, oh, I can't watch myself, like, I just can't. But he was like, I love it. He's like, sure. I absolutely love it. I love it if it's a premiere and there's people laughing. I love being in the front row. And I was like, oh, thank God. Thank God someone's just come out and said it.
Well, I do think watching yourself is your greatest teacher. It's just uncomfortable. I mean, because you're just like, bullshit, if something's not.
Well, you know all your tells, you know? Don't you? You know all the things that you do.
Yeah.
Like, I've done, I remember when I first started, because I never went to drama school or anything, and so the whole experience of learning how to act was all on camera for me. So I haven't really gone back and watched anything I did when I first started, but I know when I was looking at things at the time, I would do this weird, like, tense mouth thing where my mouth would tense up and push to the side, almost like I was gritting my teeth when it wasn't my line.
Yeah.
And no one else seemed to notice it, but I was like, oh my God, there it is. Like, there is me freaking out mid-scene, like my mouth is tensing up and I'm pouting.
Yeah, like I don't know what to do when I'm not speaking, so I'm just going to hold my face funny. Yeah. Totally.
I totally
feel you, brother.
I wish it could have been like a cooler, you know, like, I'm sure James Dean, like, you know, the squinting and the pouting, you know, was him also going through the same. It just looked a lot cooler when he did it.
Yeah, sure. Totally. Totally. It's so many things like that. I think I do a bit of a funny thing like that with when I have an American accent
mm.
In a TV show, like I notice that I hold my mouth differently.
Yeah.
And maybe that's required for vowel sounds or whatever.
Mm.
But all I see is bullshit.
Yeah.
So I actually have the most trouble watching myself in an American bit because A, I'm listening for all the vowels that are wrong and all the little things that maybe I'm getting away with most people, but I'm like, you know, nonsense.
Mm.
But also I do see just this slight tension in my mouth and I'm like, get off the screen.
Are you someone who, when you first came to LA, when you would go into a room, would you go in with the accent already on or would you just be natural and then drop into it?
Oh, God, it's been so long since I've done an audition because of COVID. I think I'd go in with the accent, yes, and just not do a lot of preamble, you know, so that I wouldn't feel caught out if they were like, how'd you get here? And I'm like, I took the 101. Oh, fuck it. Like, I didn't want, like, you know, and then you've dropped your bundle in front of everyone and said soda or something. I think I would just keep the preamble kind of short, stay in accent, and then when I knew they were done, I'd kind of be like, "Fuck, get out," and I'd be like, "Whoa!"
I did a couple where I went in with the American accent,
a bit of an effect. I bunyipped them a bit.
Yeah, where they would start going through my CV and saying, "Oh, well, you're Australian," and I'd be, "Yeah, I'm an Aussie. I was born in Melbourne," and you're just like, "What am I doing? This is so fucking stupid." Like I should have just dropped it, but you're just like, oh no, I can't let them see behind the facade. I think someone said to me early on, oh, don't let them know you're an Australian because then they'll be listening for the Australian and that'll count against you. So the first few times.
Right, but if they've got your resume, they're
they know.
I guess you went to the one audition where someone fucking read your resume. Like I just feel like more often than not, they have no idea who's coming in. They don't care.
Yeah.
And if you happen to be good, then they'll look up.
Yeah. It also sucks that my name, I have particular trouble with. Like saying Charlie Clawson with an American accent is kind of tough. Yeah. Charlie Clawson, because he's sort of, it's just
it's totally different.
Yeah, the vowel sounds and the rhotic R right in the middle of Charlie sucks.
Yeah.
And there has been times where I've tried to, like, you know, give myself my own name, Charlie.
Hi, I'm Charlie.
Just struggling with my own name.
Awful.
I'm not sure if you can hear that at the moment, but Iona, she's got some toys in the adjacent living area.
I can't hear anything.
Oh, good. She has this one fucking puzzle thing that it's like an animal puzzle where you match the animals to the shapes. But behind in the hole,
she's very gifted.
Oh, she is. She is very gifted. I'm starting to think. I want to see the act. I mean, I'm pretty sure I conceived her, but I just want to make sure that Gemma didn't have sex with a much smarter person than me.
Because I see.
Her
sure.
grasp of language now, like we're looking through a kid's book the other day. She's 2.5, and the opening page is just like a what'd you call it? Like a collage of sea creatures, you know, octopus and whale. She was just going through naming like all the animals and even like an idiot.
Wow.
She gets to seahorse and she's like, seahorse. And I correct her. I'm like, horsefish. Oh, hang on. No, wait.
Stop it.
It's a seahorse. Horsefish.
Oh my God, horsefish.
God damn it. But anyway, so she has this puzzle.
No, Iona, you dumb. Yeah,
it's a horsefish. Horsefish. Don't embarrass me. So she's got this puzzle thing and it's got these infrared sensors in it. So as you put the animal into the hole, so it's like a monkey and a snake and a gorilla and all that kind of stuff, it makes the noise of the animal. But this thing just triggers itself. Like the infrared sensors must be just catching the light and stuff. So every now and then you'll just hear like the growl of a tiger or a hissing of a snake. And I can't tell you, I'm often down here late at night in the office working and I'll be turning off all the lights and I'll be going to go upstairs and I'll fucking hear a snake or hear a tiger growl or an elephant and it scares the shit out of me. And I'm like, I have to take the batteries out of this fucking thing.
We just had to dissect our Roomba because it's plugged in not far from Joni's room. And lately it's just got a gremlin in it and goes, boo-boo, and you're like, shut the fuck up. Like, you're going to wake up the baby. Stop it. And we've made it a full person. We've called him Dustin because he used to pick up dust.
Yeah, I get it.
And Dustin is in so much trouble and Dustin's like, in four pieces right now under our bed, and like we're mad at him because we've moved him so many times. And then even like we took a big part of it out and we thought he's dead now, like he dead.
Yeah.
And then we're like, boo boo. What is happening, Dustin?
He's just compiling. Gremlins. He's just been gathering data on you as well. That's the other thing. You don't realize it, but he knows more about you than your own family, and he's going to hold it against you just when you go to throw him out.
I think so. Well, they're quite smart. They can like turn corners and laser shit. I don't know.
Do they actually clean though? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
So, but where does it go? Aren't they tiny? Like, where do they suck it up to?
They are tiny. You've got to kind of take the cartridge out and pull all, it's a lot of dog hair over here.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like, okay, it's not like, someone's come in here with a Dyson and done a good job.
Deep clean, yeah.
But if you just want a bit of a tidy, you've got one level house, which we do. It's like, set Dustin off, go outside, have a coffee, come back 40 minutes later. He might be just like mounting, you know, a footstool in trouble, but otherwise, you know, does a pretty good job.
So they,
I hate vacuuming. It's just not for me. And so I just bought it.
I got to tell you, Harry, there's a few things that I thought I didn't like, you know, when I was a younger single man that now as a fully domesticated family man, I love, and it all comes down to the quality.
You love vacuuming?
I love it because we bought a really cool vacuum. Like it's like what I realize is as you get older, especially for an older man, is you replace the toys you played with as a kid with grown-up toys. That's why Bunnings is packed every weekend because you've got a bunch of just big kids going in there because it's all the same. It's the same process.
Need you, new drill.
Yeah, need new drill, but you buy the drill, but then there's an attachment you can buy for. Just like, you know, you used to get like Castle Grayskull, but then you could also get all these things to plug into Castle Grayskull. It's the same upsell.
Totally.
So I bought this amazing vacuum, but then I'm like, oh, but I need to be able to get the spider webs up there. And so
what do you reckon? What do you got there?
It's called a Tynell, T-Y-N-E-L-L. Oh, okay. It's not one of your Dysons or your major brands. But we went into the vacuum shop and they did the whole demonstration with like the bowling ball and he tipped over like.
Did they really?
Yeah, and they tipped like the thing of powder, flour onto the floor. Yeah, I think it was like a Godfrey's. But it's like it's cordless and it comes with, it's sexy. Like I know we have to be careful talking about this, you know, the fetishization of weapons and stuff, but it feels like a futuristic. I feel like I've got a futuristic gun, the way I clip things on and I slap in a new battery and charge it up and it's got like a digital display.
Just filled with fingernails and bullshit. Yeah,
just sucking up dead spiders and stuff like that.
And dead skin.
But I quite like it. Even Jem, Jem is like allergic to housework or doing the dish. I do all the cooking. I do most of the cleaning, all that kind of stuff. But Jem is even like, oh, I like this. It's got a headlight. So when you're vacuuming, it highlights where the dust is. So like it shows it up. So you just blast. It's like,
okay, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. But that's how I get my kicks these days.
I don't think you're alone in that. Like I think a lot of – I think vacuuming in our – maybe in our parents' generation was very much just like part of housework, something that the woman did. But now that a vacuum is like a gadget and there's balls that go around and all this stuff, like we're very much engaged. I don't mean to be heteronormative here, but like a male user.
Yep.
My brother is obsessed with his vacuum cleaner.
Right.
My father's obsessed with his vacuum cleaner. I don't know if Paddy's quite there.
Yeah.
But he definitely uses it more than I do.
That's interesting. I think that whether or not it was a conscious decision to let's go to a more traditional male market or not, it does feel.
I wonder.
It does feel like. I mean, even the way it's designed is, it looks like an Apple product. It's all sleek and futuristic, and like I said, like touchscreen displays, and like it feels kind of. I remember that Jen.
There's such a light in your eyes, and it's more than when you spoke of your daughter. Okay.
Oh, don't get me started on my Ryobi lawnmower, leaf blower, and whippersnipper combo that I bought.
Okay.
Well, because we became.
We need like a woofer with the bag. We need one of those.
The leaf blower thing.
Badly. Well, I don't want to blow them into a pile. I want them to be sucked up.
I didn't know you could do that.
We live underneath two giant pecan trees. Mm-hmm. Did I say that right? Pecan?
Pecan.
Pecan.
Oh, God. Australia, we say, what do we say?
Oh, God.
Pecan. I don't know. Pecan. I say, we say pecan, as into we in a can.
Because over here it's pecan pie.
Yeah, we
said. I'm going to have peanuts, pecans. Oh, goodness. Anyway, those trees.
So do you get pecan? Oh, God, now you got me doing. Mm-hmm. Do you get pecan nuts dropping on you?
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, normally around Thanksgiving. But, like, this time of year, it just drops these. They're probably, like, 4 inches long, these yellow, fluffy worms.
All right.
That are just, I don't know, spawn.
Yeah.
And they just fly off, and the squirrels run up the trees, and they're adorable, and then they fight and play up there, and they just shake down all this shit, and our baby just wants to eat them, eat them, right, eat right, them, eat right. them. And I'm assuming that they're not toxic because she's had more of that than solid food in her life.
So you want to suck those up?
Yeah, I want to get rid of them because they're unsightly as well. Anyway, but yeah, you can put them in a bag. Like, you can get a leaf blower that is like a vacuum cleaner, get all the shit in a bag and empty it.
So it's a leaf sucker.
Leaf sucker. Anyway, you said you had a 3-in-1.
No, I'm saying is like, see, Ryobi, again, this is how they get you. The battery for the Ryobi product, it's called the Power of One, much like the Stephen Dorff movie of the same name from 1990. Remember that? The boxing, South also, African boxing. Also, aren't we thinking of
like Eckhart Tolle here?
The Power of Now.
Isn't it Eckhart?
The Power of Now. Oh, have you read that book?
I think I read like the first 12 pages, like everyone in my drama school.
I did the audio book, and it took me almost 6 months to get through because Eckhart Tolle, I'm not sure if you've heard him speak, but he has his real, I think he's German or Dutch, but he has his monotone and he does everything like this. And you just listen to the, you know, you concentrate, why put your mind into the future. And after about 2 minutes, you're like, I'm asleep. It's the best so thing to sleepy. Listen to. Yeah, Eckhart Tolle, the Power of
That's
Now.
That's pretty good.
Power of Sleep, Eckhart, listening to your voice. but these
I don't know. I feel like I'm ready for him.
It's actually a good book. I think he, I mean, you know, the main takeaway, we all are aware of mindfulness now, but this idea that, you know, he talks about the pain body, which is the stuff that we carry with us, you know, things that were done to us in the past, injustices that we hold on to. And, you know, he says that we are either holding on to these things in the past or we're projecting into the future, you know, that sort of anxiety, that metaphor about anxiety being about worrying about things that haven't happened yet, and depression being the thing about being mired into the past. And his whole philosophy, as the title would suggest, is that, you know, if you can actually focus enough to just literally live from moment to moment, you will never be bored. You will never be anxious because you don't have time to do it because you're dealing with what's in front of you right now. It's just the problem is when you get those racing thoughts. I mean, that's Gemma and Iona and I, we often do this thing in the morning where we state our feelings, how we're feeling. Like, you know, as we're driving Gem to the airport today and I asked Iona how she was feeling. She said, I'm feeling happy. I asked Gem how she was feeling and she said, I feel excited. And then she said, how do you feel? And I said, I feel anxious. But I always feel anxious, you know, like anxiety kind of just like sits under the surface of everything. I have more dominant.
Everything for you?
Yeah.
I'm really sorry to go off Ryobi.
No, this is much better. But, this is much more interesting. I had nowhere to go with that anyway. I had the power of nothing.
My OCD was like, I've got to just bring that Ryobi back.
Don't worry about it.
I'm interested because I've got anxiety bad,
right?
And it's like bad at the moment, you know.
Oh, there's the fair reason. Not like,
I guess so, but I always make these shitty excuses for like why I shouldn't be. So like I've got a fair reason to be sure because we haven't had a break in a while. We all just had COVID. We've been traveling around. We've got a baby, like whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like, literally today I was driving and I'm thinking, everyone's got anxiety, Harriet. It's the fucking modern thing. Just let it go. Just come and be better, you know, do better or whatever. But it's that's actually not true.
Mm.
You know, I know for a fact that Patty, my husband, does not have anxiety. So the two people in this house, only I do.
Yeah.
So it has to be true that I have it and I have to look it in the eye. But it's tricky. Sometimes it's like easier to sit in the noise of it and just feel that free-falling feeling rather than actually address it and assess it and go, this is such a gross thing I'm feeling, kind of. Well, I find myself sitting in the static noise of it too much.
Yeah, I mean, I've sort of been in and out of therapy. I think I sort of first went into it, I wasn't aware that I was having anxiety. I don't think it was a nervous breakdown, but I had like a emotional episode where.
When was that?
Oh, like 7 years ago. It was actually in the last year that my mum was alive. She had been ill for a while, but, you know, things were sort of getting towards the end. And, you know, she had a great attitude about it and there was nothing kind of nefarious. You know, she was in her 80s or anything like that. So it wasn't like there was other factors, but, you know, there was obviously something going on that I wasn't aware of because it just sort of happened. We actually had a party and when I got home from the party, I just had this complete emotional, like it took completely blindsided me. And Jem was really astute. You know, she's sort of, her family have had a history of depression and she's dealt with depression herself. So she was much more in tune with what was going on. And so she recommended that I, you know, go get a mental health assessment and I did. And so they recommended this psychologist and I saw this woman, she was great. I saw her for about 2 years and it started off as like, I guess grief counseling at first, because, you know, I sort of started saying to her, look, my mother's dying. I know she's going to die. And, that's inevitable. And these are the feelings it's bringing up. And, you know, I lost my dad when I was 10. And I think there's a lot of this sort of, you know, damaged child is coming to the fore and a lot of that stuff is being triggered. And she was really good at just normalizing it, I guess, because I had an attitude similar to you, which was like, we're just, you know, everyone suffers from a degree of anxiety and, you know, you've got a loving partner, a good job, good circle of friends, you know, what have you got to complain about? But it's obviously more complex than that. And so she was, after mum, she sort of coached me through that whole process of letting go of mum. And, you know, that was a beautiful experience, you know, like I actually, you know, mum and I had a fantastic kind of, you know, final weekend together where we said goodbye to each other. And it was like really emotional, but really beautiful and kind of helped me. I don't know if undo is the right word, but helped me close a chapter on my attitude towards death, because I'd had a fairly traumatic experience with it as a child. And this was like the complete opposite. And then from that point, because one of the things that she gave me the confidence to do was I said to her, I think there's expectations around how I should be grieving. For instance, you know, I don't know that, you know, if mum goes into a coma or anything like that, I don't know that I want to go down and be there for that, because that's how my father died. And it was really upsetting for me to see him go through that. And, you know, and going to see my dad's body after he died, like all these things had kind of like impacted me. And she was like, but you don't have to do that. Why do you have to go down for that moment? You don't have to see your mother's body if you don't want to. And I said, well, I had this great weekend with her and I just want to remember that. She's like, well, that's fine. Like, and it seemed like it's such an obvious thing, but you know, you do have this expectation of family and all these other kind of things. And it was something I sort of had to explain to my siblings that, look, you know, I've said goodbye to mum and we've had this memory and I don't feel like I want to do that next part. And so once we sort of dealt with that, then it just became about anxiety in all parts of my life, because I started to identify, you know, a lot of the issues that were coming up were things of my own. I had devised myself. It was like my own prison where I had created levels of expectation around how I should behave in certain situations, or, you know, how I should present myself, or, you know, what people would think about me, which were completely unrealistic. And what she helped me understand is that you just go through these, you know, this idea that we should be happy all the time is complete nonsense. And in fact, like, you know, happiness used to just describe luck. I think the origin of the word is rooted in luck, which is the idea that if you have a good harvest and your kids are healthy and all that kind of stuff, you know, that you're lucky, you know, you had a good year and that made you happy.
Yeah.
But it was never meant to be a persistent state. You know, we go up and down, and what you've got to do is just realize that, you know, when things are good, you know, that's great, but, you know, don't expect them to last forever. But when things are bad, it's the same thing. They're bad and that sucks, and you reach out for support, but know that they don't last forever. And, you know, I've sort of ebbed and flowed with it since. You know, she broke up with me, my therapist. It was traumatic. She got another job. She moved to Adelaide and she said to me, because it'd been 2 years by that point, and she was like, we can continue this, or I could, you know, recommend someone else that you can see in Sydney, and that's what I would recommend. And I was like, oh no, but I don't want you to go. And she's like, I think it'd be very healthy for you to find someone else. So I did, and he was great as well. And he was completely different. He had a bit more of that male energy. She was very kind of calming and very maternal, and I felt very safe with her. And he was much more pragmatic.
Probably the right vibe for you know, when your mum's passing away.
Yeah, exactly. And so with the second guy, it was much more, it wasn't tough love, but he was just very pragmatic in that, you know, that way of like, well, these problems are simple, you know, and you can deal with them, and you're an adult and you've got to this point in your life. You know, if the things that you've been through in your life and the obstacles you've faced to get to where you are now, and you haven't succumbed to addiction, you haven't succumbed to self-harm, you haven't succumbed to any of these kind of things. So what makes you think that if something bad were to happen that you couldn't also cope with that? And I was like, yeah, I guess you're right. You know, like you sort of look at your, we imagine the worst possible scenario and feel like, oh, I couldn't possibly go on if this terrible thing happened. But the fact of the matter is you do, and people do. I mean, I feel like I should probably go back into therapy. It's been a while now. And just because I don't like leaning on Jem too hard or my friends too hard. And, you know, where we're living is kind of, it's, we've got friends around, but, you know, we're at a stage of our lives
it's
now where
more
everyone's
remote,
And everyone's got their own families and their own shit to deal with. And I just don't. I would rather pay someone like a prostitute.
emotional prostitute.
I would rather pay an emotional prostitute just to take my filthy problems off me. and I would feel better about it because you do sort of, you know, walk away from that. I mean, I think there is an element when you're talking to your friends and your family that you can't be 100% candid just because you have to be aware of the relationship you have with them.
Yeah, and like, you can be a bit ugly in therapy. You're supposed to be anyway, I think. You know, it's the underbelly, little worms under the rock.
How do you motivate yourself? Like when you're talking about watching yourself on screen and you get critical, or, you know, even thinking about your anxiety and getting critical about that, is that critic very strong in your mind?
Is my critic strong? Yeah, I think definitely. It's the anxiety at the moment is more just, I think it's about, maybe it's about happiness, and it's interesting that you say that. I'm going to really think about that, because I think being a happy person is something that I've always prided myself on, and I had some really big personalities in my family growing up with big emotions, and I'd be like, why can't we all just be happy? Like, happy is the way forward. Like, I was like, have you seen that movie Inside Out?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was joy. I was like, we got to stop being sad. Everyone stop it. Like, that was me. But I used to sometimes, and especially in the early days with Patty, I'd be like, hey, are you happy? And he'd be like, yeah. And I'd be like, why aren't you happy? And he'd be like, I am. What the fuck? And like, what I've learned from him, and I'm understanding a bit more now that we've that happiness and luck thing, is like, enjoy the happiness when you feel it, but actually the pressure that you put on yourself to just be happy all the time, it's not good, is it?
It's like that passive, it's like that passive aggressive positivity you get when you see like Scientologists talking. It's that kind of, it's like, it's almost like it feels artificial. Like no one is that positive. Yeah. No one is that, you know, self-motivated. What are you covering for, or what are you compensating for? There's something that you are obviously in denial of. And it's not to say that people, you know, you don't have people who are genuinely amiable and happy, but I think you're right. Like if it becomes a rod to which to, you know, beat yourself or question your relationships or question your job or whatever, then it's not helpful at all.
And it's the shoulds for me. Like I think I'm struggling right now because I should be really happy. Like all my boxes are ticked, you know. We have this beautiful little home that we're able to buy in LA a couple of years ago. We have this beautiful baby sleeping in the room over there. We have a beautiful dog. We have our health. All of our parents are alive and still married. Do you know what I mean? And I have kicked this huge goal career-wise in terms of writing the show, producing the show, and acting in the show. And yet, it's like wherever you go, there you are. And it's like, here's Harriet, still Harriet. Like, yeah. Like I've actually booked myself in to get a haircut and color tomorrow, and I'm like, I'm gonna feel so different tomorrow. And it's like, and then I'm gonna probably get in my car, Charlie, look at myself in the rearview mirror and cry because I'm still there.
Yeah, well, it's interesting.
It's I don't mean to like make fun of myself or whatever, but it's right now I'm putting pressure on myself to feel something and I'm not feeling it, and I do think it's probably about fatigue.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I especially
think it's truly about fatigue.
I mean, and don't discount like the motherhood thing as well. Like, I mean, I think
the shoulds with motherhood is cuckoo.
Yeah, 100%. It's not only just the kind of the shoulds, but it's also the what ifs, you know, like because all of a sudden you have this thing of immense value, and you love it like you've never loved anything before. I try with Iona often to even sit within that kind of nervousness and the anxiousness of the what ifs and the shoulds and all that kind of stuff, because it's not going to last, you know. And even in the 2.5 years that she's been around, she's transformed so much. Like, you know, they're a baby for this long, and then they're an infant for this long, and then a toddler. And it's only about 2 or 3 years, and well, you know, a year for an infant, and then a toddler for 2 or 3 years, and then she's going to be a kid, and before you know it, she'll be like an adolescent, then a teenager. It doesn't make it any easier, though.
But don't you find that pressure kind of ruins it? It's like,
well,
I'm struggling to hold Joanie and be like, this is so precious and beautiful. I'm just seeing that it's fleeting and therefore painful.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, it's
like, how can you truly enjoy something? It's like, I think I've got to read Eckhart, man.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know that intellectualizing does help with it. I think it's just more about, you are going to intellectualize it and you are going to think about the fleeting nature of it. That's just going to happen. It's just the moments where you catch yourself by surprise. Like, you know, the other day Iona was bouncing on a trampoline and like falling over and laughing every time she stumbled like clumsily onto her ass. She'd lie on her back and she would laugh. And I remember at the time I was trying to get off the tramp because I had a meeting with someone else. And then I just was like so, like for a moment, just caught up in watching her laugh that it just took me by surprise. And that's, you know, the Eckhart Tolle thing. If I was all of a sudden I was in the moment, and it was just about that singular moment. And it's not to say that I won't go back to the worry and the shoulds and the what ifs and all that other kind of stuff, but it's just enjoying those moments when you have them. Like, I don't know about you, but there's something about a sleeping baby. Oh my God. Like, they can be the biggest terror while they're awake, but then as soon as they're asleep, you're like, I love you so much. Like, you know, it's just.
Do you mean like sleeping on you or sleeping in the other room?
In the other room, whatever. It's just like, Iona goes from being a gremlin, like a full blown, get me an old priest and a young priest. This thing is possessed. To then just being the most beautiful, like, thing I've ever seen in my life, all in the space. Like, last night, she was saying the meanest things to me. Like, she was telling me she didn't love me. She was telling me to get out of her room. She was telling me that mum's better than you. Like, it was the cruelest, like, most mean girl kind of stuff. And I'm just sitting there taking it, you know. She's, like, trying to hit me. She's just having full overtired tantrums. And I'm just sitting there going, this fucking sucks, man. Like, it fucking sucks.
Yeah.
Like, I do so much for this kid and she doesn't appreciate it. Mum just swans in and gets, like, all the praise. But then she fell asleep and I was like, look at her. Oh, my God, she's amazing. Let's wake her up. I miss her.
Stop it. It's so funny that it must be a defense mechanism. It must be a way to keep them living.
Yeah, and look, my ego is so gigantic. Oh, I thought you meant more the yelling at dad and time to get fucked.
No, I'm so sorry. I mean,
looking so cute.
The way a baby smiles around week six, just when you're about to throw them out the window. You're like, I'm going to put you in this trash can. And then they give you the smile and you're like, wait a second.
Wait a minute, it's doing something
similarly,
new.
Like putting the baby down at 7:30, my goodness, from 10 to 7:28, she is bananas and just kicking me in the tits and pulling my hair and like all that stuff. And I have to make the choice to be the adult.
Yeah, it's like, hard,
I have to
man.
Choose to be the adult in the room because otherwise there isn't one. But like as soon as I close the door and I check the monitor and she's out, I'm like, yeah, see you tomorrow, cutie. Like,
yeah. Well, it's weird. Like it's ego. It's all ego with me. You'd think I'm a grown ass man. You think that I would not have my ego threatened by a baby, but it's fucking true. I get jealous. I get jealous of the way, you know, like the bond she has with her mum. I get jealous of the way that Jem looks when she looks at her. And like I'm the youngest of nine kids. And, you know, I know that talking to mum about dad is like dad had a lot of anxiety. You know, that's my memory of dad. You know, he was a good dad, but he was an anxious dad. Like I just remember him. He always just seemed to be like coiled, you know, just like life was tough and he was pissed off all the time. And talking to mum about that, you know, she said that, he was of an era where men didn't have that emotional kind of intelligence, or they weren't taught to understand their emotions like, you know, we are now. But he was jealous he had nine kids and each one of them he saw his wife fall in love with and he didn't know how to take it. And I even know, like with my eldest brother who, you know, they had the most amount of conflict because my brother was gay. And, you know, that was a bit of a thing for my father to kind of deal with and stuff. But then, you know, on his deathbed, he wrote my brother this beautiful letter, like, and he apologized for it all and said, like, when I saw, you know, the way your mother looked at you the first time, I knew that I could never compete. And I get that.
Wow.
You know, like, I totally get that. And it's not to say I'm proud of it, but, you know, it is something that as fathers, like, you sort of, that bond between mother and child, it can be so strong sometimes that you just have to realize that you are no longer the number one in their eyes. Like they have someone else in their life who not only needs their mother, but you know, they are drawn to, like, you know, it's just something instinctive. It's something primal.
But would you say that you're guilty of perhaps erring on the side of loving Iona more than Jem though? Like, is it both, does it go both ways?
I'd say so. I'd say that, but in different ways, you know, like,
No, you go.
I was just going to say, I think with Gems, it's more effortless. Like it's more instinctive. It's more primal.
Yeah.
I don't know if hormones are at play or whatever, but they just have a bond, you know, and she just loves her mum. Whereas for me, it's like I've had to teach her to love me. will love me. You will respect and love me.
See,
I'm
your feel
father.
A bit like you though, Charlie. Right. Like I feel like Patty and I are two dads because I know that hormones can be very helpful for, you know, natural mums, but they can also be unhelpful when you've got like postnatal depression and problems with breastfeeding and all sorts. How all that aside, it's almost like Joni was handed just to two people, like two dads. That had no physical link.
Yeah.
And so I totally get what you mean. I've had to teach Joni to trust me and, you know, curl into me. And when she had COVID like a week ago, I mean, she's still testing positive, but she was sick like a week ago. This is going to sound terrible. However, she was the sweetest little thing. My goodness.
Well, it took me just a little bit of COVID.
Ever hugged me like that before. Oh my goodness. This girl is like up and at 'em. She needs to be on all fours and pulling every cord out of everything at all times. However, the day that we tested, she had, you know, I just had it for a week. Patty had it for a week. I'm like, let's just test Joni. She looks a little weird today.
Yeah.
Shoved it up her nose. It was positive. And as the day went on, she just like got sick. And, you know, she was better the next day. You know, kids especially, you know, she has a lot of fortitude, our daughter. She's Alabama strong. She's from really strong people. But she, that day, that afternoon that she was sick, I was playing with her under the house and on this like playmat thing. And I didn't realize how sick she was. And she just crawled into my lap and just grabbed a hold of my shirt and just like stop playing with me. Like it was so, she's 8 months old. She's still a baby. And I scooped her up and she just lay in my arms staring like ahead of her for 30 minutes. And then my legs got sore. So I kind of moved into the, and she just, she didn't want, like normally Joni is like, oh, you can hug me for 3 seconds and then I have to go. Like I've got to go.
Yeah.
And she just lay on me for a couple of hours and then I had to move over here and do something else. And she just was like a newborn.
Wow.
Except she was, you know, smudgy and cool. And I just, it was, I was high on it. And the next day I was like, oh, she's better.
Bummer. Well, this is the clear path forward is you need to employ a bit of Munchausen syndrome.
Munchausen, that's right.
Let her know she's ill for the rest of her life and she'll always need you.
Yeah, you're very sick, Johnny. Yeah, it was actually, it sounds so dark, but it was a really nice moment for us. And
yeah. And
actually she's kind of like, you know, you're saying you've taught Anna, she's kind of been more clingy since, more like,
right. Oh,
I can turn to that. That's a source of comfort.
Comfort, yeah. Yeah, it's funny because they, I remember when we were doing the kind of birth, what do you call it, birth training, whatever, the, you know, you learn how to have a baby, whatever it was called.
Birth school?
Something like that.
Pecan?
Yeah,
I don't know.
But they were
birthing classes. I don't know. Again, I'm not part of it.
they talked a lot about the oxytocin, which is the hormone that's produced. That's the, you know, the birth mothers have, and you're meant to do a lot of skin to skin when the baby's born.
Yes.
Like back in the old days, you know, of putting a woman in stirrups and getting the baby out and then separating. It's incredibly cruel. Like that's just not the way biological beings bond. You know, they need time together, especially straight after birth. But I remember I got Iona because I was like, because they were like, oh, definitely fathers should do skin to skin as well. So mama holds on, you know, skin to skin for half an hour, then daddy can hold the baby for half an hour, skin to skin, and you just let those oxytocins flow. So I remember like I had this brand newborn on me and I'm holding her and I'm like, look at this. And she looked exactly like me when she was born as well. It was weird. That's probably another biological function, I'd say. She had dark hair and a little squishy, wow. A little squishy face like mine. And now she looks more like her mum. She's got the big eyes and the blonde hair. But I remember holding this baby and she shat all over me. Like literally just like huge, gross, sticky, stinky shit all over me. And I'm like,
oh my goodness.
Does that affect the oxytocin? Like does this shit like counteract the oxytocin?
Excuse me.
is this an opposite now where it's just like she's going to hate me for the rest of my life? Is this some kind of
Oh
omen?
My goodness. That's a good one.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, and it's that horrible grainy green shit at the start too.
Yeah, just weird.
It's like not good.
Alien stuff. But Paddy, yeah.
Paddy held Joni at the start. He was the first person to hold her because I was in LA and he was in Tampa. And he, he fed her with a bottle and the birth mom was incredibly helpful. And, it's one of the most beautiful pictures I have is actually just like a screenshot of our FaceTime that I took of him with his little shirt undone holding his baby against him. It was just, it was very beautiful. It's a very natural picture.
Yeah.
It's right. Instead of, you know, bundled up and put to the side of the room to sleep, you know.
It does. But yeah. Go on.
Before when we were talking about, you know, they've got a bond and your ego's like, I'm jealous. It's funny. As soon as Joni was born, a few days into, I think it was when they were coming back from Tampa and I was still working, but I think we wrapped and I was saying goodbye to one of my castmates and they were like, you know, enjoy Joni. You finally get to go and, you know, be spend time with her. And I was like, yeah, I'm so excited. And they go, just wait until Patty loves her more than you. And then got in their car. And I was like, what? And I kind of drove home thinking about it, like, just wait. Patty's going to love her more than you. And I was, it just like ate me up a bit. And I kind of walked through the door, and instead of kind of going straight into motherhood, I was like, hey,
do you love the baby more than me?
Do you think that he was like, fuck no, she's insane. I don't know what I'm doing. She's just been yelling at me for 8 days in Tampa. And I was like, yeah, cool, cool, cool. I was like, but do you think that you will? And he's like, I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, it would have to be different, wouldn't it? Like, it'll be different. Kind of love, because, you know, there's so many things that are, but I don't remember feeling like scared of it. I remember thinking that person was talking about themselves more, because they've got grown up children and they've been married a while, and I think they were just projecting a little bit of their own bitterness perhaps. But also, you know, it's a big love, and it's growing every day over here between all of us.
Mm.
But it is taking time.
I did hear someone said something similar to Jem, actually, and a similar situation. They've got grown-up daughters, and they were around at our place and were having a bit of a party or whatever, and the dad was dancing with his daughters, you know, and we were watching them dance, and the wife said, oh, Gemma, that's what'll happen. Charlie just want to dance with Iona. He won't want to dance with you anymore. And we were like, and I was like, that's sad. But then I'm like, but also, you guys have had 30 years to dance. Like, this is new. Like, so I can kind of get that.
Probably a very
well.
Small window within which, probably, I don't know, 12 to 18, in which the child can dance, like physically, and isn't embarrassed to be dancing with them. Like, it is a smaller window, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, in my mind, if Patty ends up loving Joni more than me, then we've done something right. We gave a kid a really loving childhood.
Yeah, but also it's not a competition. I mean, you can love people. You can love multiple people at different levels and different ways, correct?
It's a big competition right now between Walter the dog and Joni.
That was going to be my next question, because Junior stayed around for a couple of months while Iona was around, but I think he was an old dog by that stage, and I think he partly checked out. He was like, "Oh well, I can see well, where this one's going. I'm out of here."
Yeah.
And so he punched his own
ticket.
She's
getting loud. She's getting movie.
But I do often, like, I mean, it's ridiculous. You and I were talking before we started recording about Junior and you know, the dogs and kids, the similarity. But I do often think that was one in, one out. Like, so much of Iona's personality and the way she interacts with us and the way we interact with her is like a continuation of Junior. Like, we often joke that Junior left Iona some notes. Oh, this is how you manipulate them. This is how you end up in bed between them. This is because all the things that Junior used to do, like, you know, when we first got Junior, we were like, he's going to be an outdoor dog. He's not sleeping in the house. And it's like, okay, he sleeps in the house, but he sleeps on the couch in the living room. All right, he sleeps in the bedroom, but he sleeps in a basket on the floor. All right, he sleeps on the bed, but he sleeps in the internet. And then
next
before
you're having sex.
Yeah. And that's how Iona was born. Wait a minute. Now I know why she's so smart. And loves tennis balls, chasing
Russell.
Tennis balls. Yeah. But then
keeps licking herself.
But Iona now, like, her poor design with this house, but we have adjoining doors between her room and our bedroom. And so at some point during the night, she will open her little Harry Potter door and walk through and climb into bed between us. And so more often than not, I wake up with Iona like lying in between us, which is great and it's cute and cuddly and all that kind of stuff. But I'm like, wow, we have not lay in the same bed without something smaller between us for pretty much the entirety of our relationship. You know, like like our entire sex life is dictated around the fact of, can we get this small thing to stay in a different room for long enough for us to have sex?
Can we lock them out with enough TV or food?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we can get something done around here.
Sure.
But Wally, does he like having a sister? Does he like having someone else in the house? Is he protective of her?
He is. We had a few friends that were like, "You love your dog," and we're like, "We love our dog." And they're like, "Just you wait. You'll get a kid. The dog will just be in the way." Or you won't love your dog so much or whatever.
Who are these people?
It just hasn't been, I don't know, a couple of people. But actually, Patty just did a bit. I'm going to name drop here, and it's probably, she'll never hear it. Patty just did a bit on an Amy Schumer show in New York a couple of months ago.
Mm.
And she was like, "How's it going with the baby?" And Patty was like, "Oh, it's great. We love her, et cetera." And she's like, "Do you still love your dog?" And he was like, "Yeah." And she goes, "We rehomed ours once we had a kid." And I was like, "What?
Oh, no, that can't do that."
And she was like, he was like, "How long did you have the dog before the baby?" She's like, "I don't know, 4 years. I was obsessed with him. I love that dog." And then, "You're in the way. We rehomed him."
Really?
I know another couple
who did that out of more of a safety. They had a ridgeback and they were just concerned.
Oh, that's different.
I mean, it wasn't a violent ridgeback, but it was just a clumsy big dog and they were concerned that like a stray claw or whatever. But I couldn't do that. I could not do it. I would feel awful.
And if anything, like, I love him more because he's been really patient with her, you know, like. When she was born, he was in Tampa with Patty, so he smelt her and met her as a newborn. But then, you know, we left here when she was about 10 weeks old or something for Australia, and we had to leave Wally here. And then we came back 5.5 months later, and we've got this 8-month-old baby that's crawling and whacking him and pulling his tail. And he's like, "Wait a second. You guys, like, when you left, she was a peanut who I used to kind of sometimes lie near, and now she's hurting me." And so we had to kind of try and coach them to be a bit chill around each other. And, like, day one, Wally did this. And when I say day one, I mean, like, coming back from Australia. He did this little snap at her because she kind of cornered him, and he got in so much trouble. He learned really quickly, and he hasn't done it again. Mm. And now he's like forgiven us. He was very cool with us when we first came back. Like, "How could you take her and not me?" But he now is concerned about her, you know, when she cries, or when she had COVID, he was like, didn't leave her side. And when she cries, like, Patty, anytime we have to rat test her, which we're doing all the time, or like snot sucker, stuff like that, she screams like a banshee, and Walter is right there. Right. Because he loves her. It's just, it's just nice knowing that one day she'll be at school and be like, "My dog, Wally, yada, yada, yada. Like, she is now, he is now her dog too. It's just that we have to make sure there's enough personal space because he's a very funny little gentleman.
Well, we've got friends who live in just down the road from us who have been away. One of them got sick and they had this dog. This beautiful dog called Banner, who's like a, what is he? He's like a cavoodle or a labradoodle or one of those kind of curly haired weird dogs. And so he came to stay with us for a while.
Probably about
3 weeks. And he is the chillest dog going around. Like, he's just the best. He doesn't beg for food. He just follows you around. He just wants to pat and just wants to light your feet. Like, he's awesome. He occasionally barks and there's a knock at the door or whatever. And so it has been the best training dog for Ayana because she'll go up and put her arms around his neck and nuzzle him and stroke his ears and drag him into bed with her and try and put a hat on him and all this kind of stuff. Like, she loves him. But he does it. And part of me thinks, like, because I never had a pet growing up. It wasn't until I got Junior. That was my first ever, like, proper pet. And I think it taught me so much about compassion and patience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, it sounds to people who, like, when I meet people who say, "I don't like dogs," I'm always like, "What the fuck is wrong with you? Like, how can you not like
what
dogs?" Like, you must be damaged because they are nothing but that unconditional love. But also, I do think that they teach you, they're like a mirror. They hold up to you your own kind of, like, flaws and insecurities and all that kind of stuff. So, I do. Part of me thinks I would love Ayana to have a dog just so she can learn those lessons as well, you know, because she doesn't have siblings yet. So, you know, maybe you know, or if she never does have a sibling, I'm not even sure, you know, if we're going to go down that path, but if she doesn't, like at least having this companion will give her all those things that I learned. But then the other side is like, I can just borrow my friend's dogs and then I can give them back and I don't have to worry about paying for the vet or feeding them or anything.
So you're not sure you're ready for a new dog? As you said before, we started.
I think we're more ready for another kid than we are for a dog, just because I think it's harder to and more expensive to get people to look at. We still travel quite a bit for work, and so just getting the dog minded would be difficult. Mm-hmm. And also in this house that we've bought, we're in this little cul-de-sac. And it's great, you know, safe area and stuff, but there's no fences. And the previous owners, they told us they had a dog like Junior, a Jack Russell, and that it was just constantly, like, we've got a big reserve next to us and it's a busy road down there. And the dog was just constantly getting out. So I don't know we could secure it. We'd have to leave it in the house, which would suck. I don't want to leave a dog in the house. I'd like to. Did I tell you, did you hear the story about me stealing my neighbor's dog?
No.
I mean, this will be boring for anyone who listens to TOEFOP, the other podcast I do. But I'll just quickly tell you because I need to get your opinion on this. So Gem and I came back from being away for a couple of days and we had new neighbors who'd moved in while we'd been away. We hadn't met them yet. And we came back and we could hear this dog like barking, bark, 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 you know. And so I was like, oh, it's going for a while. We'd put Iona down. The dog was still barking. It was keeping her awake. So I go around and knock on the door. There's clearly no one home. I go around to the back fence and see through the gate there's this little dog, like a little terrier with a collar on. So I get the number off the collar and I text, hey, you know, this is Charlie. I'm your next door neighbor. Your dog's been barking for a couple of hours now. It seems kind of distressed, just letting you know. Didn't hear anything back. Dog's still barking. And so I say to Jem, like, I'm just going to get the dog and bring it into the house because maybe that'll stop it barking. And it might be scared. Who knows? It might be a snake in the backyard or whatever. So I jump the fence and I get the dog. And then I send another text message. And the first one was, I must admit, a little passive aggressive. I was like, your dog is being barked. My daughter can't, you know, whatever.
Second text I sent. Nothing like the rage when something's keeping your baby away.
Yeah. The second text was a lot more like, hey, I've just taken your dog inside. He'll be here when you get home, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, this dog was sweet and very cute and we didn't have any dog food or anything. I was giving it Weet-Bix, gave it some like Weet-Bix and milk to eat. And I stayed downstairs with it. Like I slept on the couch with it and he was very cuddly. He loved it. And then the next morning it's like, oh shit, I need to take him out for a walk. But we don't have a lead or anything. So I'm sort of like holding his collar and you know, walking him down to the nature strip so I can do a poo. The neighbors come home. I see them pull in. And so I put the dog under my arm.
What time do they call this?
It was like 10 a.m. the next day. So I think like where the backyard he was in, there was a dog house and there was water and food, but he wasn't in the house. And so I walk up their driveway and I'm like, hello. And they're like, oh my God, did the dog get out? We're so sorry. And I'm like, no. Well, the dog got out, but this is how he got out. I jumped your fence. And they're like, what happened?
My God, I said
he was barking. He was barking and I was worried that he was distressed or, you know, he was scared. So I just brought him in. And the guy was like, why didn't you call me? I said, I did. I sent you two texts. And then I remembered as soon as I said that the first text had been kind of passive aggressive, a bit shitty. And so he started like, he's like, oh, they've just come through now. And I'm like, oh, you know, yeah, you don't need to. It's too late. Like he read them. I was like, oh, anyway. So I'm Charlie. This is Gemma. You know, anytime you want to drop the dog around. So I told that story.
I read that first text in a rush.
yeah. I told that story in TOEFOP and it divided our audience. There were some people who were like, you stole a dog, man. Like you can't just jump someone's fence and take their dog. And the other half of the audience were like, no, Matt, you did the right thing. You hear a dog in distress. You don't let that dog just bark. Where do you sit on that debate?
I think you did the right thing. I do. Because you gave him comfort and I also, it's not, it's better to have no dog barking for everyone.
Yeah.
You know?
Would you not feel, if you were the neighbors, would you feel a little weirded out that the neighbor you'd never met felt comfortable enough to jump your fence?
I probably would. And I'd be like, so Charlie's weird. Yeah. He's been in our house. He's worn my underwear.
Which I did. Still, but it was exactly. All to make the dog feel more comfortable.
Yeah, honey. But I still think you did the right thing. And you know what? I actually came home once when I lived in Elizabeth Bay. I lived in this really old block of flats. So it was like 21 units or something. And I'd had a bunch to drink, maybe other things. Who knows? I was in my 20s. Life was good. And I came home and there was this beautiful little white dog just kind of like walking around sniffing like the carpet. I'd never seen it before. I'd never heard it before. This little fluffy thing with a little collar that said Sydney. And I was like, oh my God, I got a dog. Like, I was that drunk person and I took the dog. I didn't kind of knock on anyone's door and go, excuse me, whose dog is this? I was like, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning. I was like, my dog.
My dog.
And so I just brought Sydney into my apartment, just off chops, poured a bowl of milk. Sydney devoured it. I took Sydney to bed with me. I'm like, you're mine now, Sydney. Like, it was, I've gone full Charlie Clausen at this point. Wow. And then the next morning I woke up and she was just on the end of my bed, like this perfect little thing. And I was like, oh, someone's going to be looking for you. Bad. And I kind of went out and looked around and there was a couple of doors open and there was this like English girl who looked like she'd had a big night and she was like, something, I'm not Sydney and I don't know where she went. And I'm like, oh, hello. did you just say Sydney or are you looking for a dog? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, oh, I've got her. And she wasn't really mad. She was kind of grateful. She was like, oh, thank God. Someone yeah. had her and she wasn't on the street or whatever. I said, I gave her some milk, I gave her some cuddles. And I was like, she's welcome back anytime. She's like, oh, you're so sweet. My door shut in my face. But I was yeah. like, Sydney gave me a gift that night. And I was, there was just no way I wasn't taking that dog to bed with me. So I totally feel you.
Well, look, the neighbors and I have become good friends since that. In fact, we had lunch about 2 weeks ago and they kind of, they're not exactly sure what I do for a living. I mean, a lot of people aren't exactly sure what I do for a living, but he was aware that I do these podcasts and he was like, oh yeah, he's gone. I made a mates of mine. They were talking about that AFL one you do and you do another one well with that comedian, Will Anderson. I'm like, yeah. And he's gone, should I listen to it? And I'm like, absolutely not. Never listen. Never listen, especially episodes 364 to 367 where we discuss your dog at great length and we get like, we run a poll with our audience.
He definitely listened.
I don't think so. Do you think he did?
I think so. Absolutely. If you tell someone not to listen to a thing, they're going to listen to a thing.
I don't know. Well, look, I don't describe him or the dog in any bad way. It's all a joke about me. But when I did it, it wasn't even a question of like me weighing up whether or not I should do it. I just acted on instinct. I just grabbed the damn dog. It wasn't until I told the story publicly that I was made aware that perhaps I had breached some kind of like neighbor code or something like
sure.
that.
Sure. You're Peter Parker. Napped.
Yeah.
Totally.
That's right.
Patty goes full Peter Parker mode. Like, I do worry sometimes it's going to get us into trouble or him into trouble. Are you saying
Peter Parker is in he shoots webs out of his wrists or like?
No, just a little bit like friendly neighborhood fixer.
Great power, great responsibility, all that kind of stuff.
Well, I think it could more be a like little the S on the chest as well.
Right, okay.
Like, he got himself, I mean, he could have got himself into a lot of trouble, but when we used to live in Beechwood, there's this kind of back road that you drive up, and he was driving behind a car, and it was a little bit all over the road, and then it just rammed into a parked car, and the bumper fell off. And then they kind of reversed and just drove off. And Pat was like, Peter Parker mode activated and just followed the car. And then it was like he followed it into a cul-de-sac. And these two women got out of the car and they were off their tits, maybe just stoned, I don't know. But they were, you know, inebriated. And they'd gotten out of the car in the cul-de-sac to look at the damage on the front of their car. And Patty kind of pulled in behind them and he got out and he was like, hey, sorry, I saw you hit a car. are you going to like do anything about that? And they were so panicked that then they got in their car and it hit another car. And then sped off. And then a woman whose car that was, she ran out of her house like, what's just happened? And Patty was like, I was trying to help. And then, like, he spooked these women who then made cost more damage. But the funniest bit was he was like, I've got to get back to the initial house where they really fucked up a car. I've got to let them know, because all he also wanted was their number plate. So he took a picture of their number plate, right?
Yeah.
Peter Parker drives himself back to the initial accident. And there's a woman out there inspecting her car, which has been pretty fucked up. But what's so funny is that the car that he followed to get the number plate, their bumper had fallen off and left the number plate there at at the initial hit. So he didn't have to follow them. They'd already left their details.
Could have saved that other woman's car.
Totally. And he kind of came back and he was all hepped up. He's like, And I was like, so wait a second. Because you followed that car, though, that's why it hit this other one's car. I was like, yeah, but, you know, I helped. And I was like, in this one, I got to say, I don't think it helped.
Citizen's arrest.
I don't think it helped. And also, this is fucking LA. You are never, ever following another fucking car again. Like, You will get shot. It's just, don't do it. Peter, keep it. Keep the webs in your pants.
Yeah.
It's not okay.
Harry, that's as good a point as any to leave it. Before we do go, when can we expect to see Colin from Accounts? When is it coming out? People in Australia, people in the US?
Great question. I'm not sure yet. There's been murmurings of July, but I feel like that's going away. So Binge has it. Foxtel's Binge. So it'll be on Foxtel and Binge.
Fantastic.
They're saying maybe July, maybe December. I'm not sure, but people over here are buying it. So there's a little bit of a... There's some chum in the water about where it's going to land, but it played at the international screenings just recently, and it was this amazing moment. I just tested negative for COVID, and we went to a dinner to celebrate Colin, and then the next night this cocktail party with these international screeners, people all over the world that saw the pilot and just loved it. And then the next morning, Patty tested positive for COVID. So we had these 2 days out in the world. Where it was all just like Colin, and then sick again, and then like we haven't really done anything since. But my answer is unhelpful. It doesn't have a when. We've just got like the first four in the can, and we're now looking at the mix and the grade and stuff on the last four. So it's
very, very exciting. Well, we'll have to get you back on when the show. Maybe we'll get you and Patty on together. We'll have a double header. You've both been on separately. We'll get you on as double header, and you can talk about Colin from Accounts. But that is it.
Hey, guess what I found in my pocket?
What?
To bring us back to Ryobi. One of the yellow worms.
Oh, they're the bloody things you got to get rid of. How annoying. And it was just in your pants?
That was in my pocket. Why was it in my like jumper pocket? Why?
It just attaches to
everywhere,
you.
Charlie.
Oh my God, you need to get one of those. You need to get a leaf sucker.
I do. Have a beautiful day. Thanks for having me.
No problem. That's Vofop for this week. I'm Charlie Clawson.
I'm Harriet Dyer.